When they returned to the center of the ville, Mildred and Christy had been able to start making some small difference. The path between the debris had also been improved by small teams under the direction of JB and Jack. They had only children to help them. The women were occupied in the infirmary, but the youth of the ville were wiry and strong. Doc, meanwhile, had continued his single-minded pursuit of his task as water-bearer, and his white hair was plastered to his scalp. His coat, long since discarded in a heap, shirt sleeves rolled up. Ryan paused for a moment, looking at the carnage with a fresh eye. The mystery writer had done this with no help, and with an arsenal that could comfortably be carried on a bike. A big bike, admittedly, but still one smaller than a wag. The writer's words, as recited by the woman, made a kind of sense to Ryan. The guy was crazy, sure, but crazy with some powerful weapons. Ryan felt his instinct for self-preservation tugging at him. They had already encountered the writer once, and by the sound of it, they'd got lucky. Maybe they wouldn't be so lucky a second time.
Ryan!
What, Jack? Anything new?
Ryan, be careful. Orange dirt. Look what happened when I touched it.
Jack held out his hand. On his palm was a red wheel, blistering at the edges.
Get Mildred to look at that.
Yeah. Wanted to show you first, though. Some chem shit stays burning a day after going off? Never seen that before.
I just got the story about what happened here. I'll fill you all in later. This was our rider, and he's one mad coldheart by the sound of it.
Jack gave the briefest of nods, turned, and went across to the infirmary. Ryan took his place in clearing rubble, and caught the expression on Mildred's face as she examined Jack's chem burn. There would be much to discuss later. By the time the sun had set and the cold night chilled their bones, the companions were exhausted. They went back to where they had tied up the wag and horses. Almost everyone else had stayed in the center of the ville. A few stragglers returned to their homes. Most wanted the security of staying close together. The house where the wag was tethered remained empty. Whether the occupant had been killed, they didn't know, and it didn't matter, except that it gave them the privacy they needed to talk about what had happened and how it affected them. After Ryan told them what he had been told, the companions all sat in silence.
Napalm. That's what it is.
Napalm? I've heard of it, but here? In the Deathlands? You sure?
I'm sure. That's what we were smelling when we approached the ville. That sweet but bitter smell, the orange on the houses and ground, Jack's chemical burn. It's serious stuff, and it's in the hands of a dangerous man.
I suppose the real question here is, do we see ourselves as knights-errant? I suspect that is what has been playing on your mind, Ryan.
You're kind of right, Doc. I feel like we need to go after this coldheart before he comes after us. And if we do that, we can maybe get what we need from here. The things we came here for in the first place.
And there's not much left in the way of provisions. From here, the next ville is who knows where. We couldn't get far.
JB took off his spectacles and polished them. It was a habit, an indication that he was thinking. Eventually, he perched them back on his nose.
We got two separate problems here. First, we got nothing in reserve, so we can't move on unless we trade with these people in some way. Now, they got jack shit, too. The only way they're going to give us what we need is if we can offer them something they want, like revenge. Second problem is that this stoop is riding around at random, blasting the shit out of Vills. Who knows where else he's been? Who knows where he'll stop? We stay in this area for any time, chances are we're going to run into him. So, we do it now or later? Seems to me the only way we solve one problem is by solving the other. That's simple.
It's got nothing to do with wanting to get your hands on his arsenal.
It could be that, too.
It took several days to help get the ville back into something approaching a functioning order. After the second day, the friends were offered food and water so they could preserve their own. No mention was made of any conditions. Rather, it was taken as payment for the work they were doing, which suited them fine at that point. The work was hard, and there was little demand beyond the immediate. Soon the time was drawing near when the friends would want to leave. Question was, would they leave with renewed supplies and a mission? The answer came on the fifth night. By now, the survivors had adopted a more communal style of living, pooling, as they were, their resources and their skills. It was while they were eating in the building that they'd adopted as their communal dining hall that Maggie, the woman Ryan had questioned on the first day, stood to address them all.
You know what we all have been through, and you know that our new visitors here have been a lot of help. But there's something else. Something some of you know about, because we've discussed it among ourselves. Ryan, you said you'd help us get the cold heart bastard who did this if we'd help you with what you wanted. You still stand by that?
I do. We all do. So happens that this mystery writer Coldheart of yours might be a threat to others, might be a threat to us. There's no reason to go looking for trouble, but maybe it'd be better to find it before it finds us. And you've been fair to us, feeding us while we work for you. So I figure you'll be reasonable about what we ask.
Depends on,
Well, it isn't much. You know that when we arrived here, we were looking to trade, pick up supplies as we were running low. You pay us in goods to go after this Coldheart, and we will. We'll need more than we've got now if we're going to make a real job of it.
Hey, how do we know you won't just go in the opposite direction as fast as you can? Forget about the rider as soon as you're out of here.
The speaker was one of the older boys, emboldened by the silence of expectation that had descended over the hall.
You don't. But you know what we're like. You've seen us work. We didn't have to do that. Weak as you are, we could have just taken what we wanted and already be long gone. So you think about that. Then you say yes or no to our terms. It's your choice.
In the end, it was no choice at all. The companion set off the next morning, before the sun was too high.
I never thought I would wish for the toiling colors of a chem cloud. But then there are many things to which I thought the word never would apply.
Don't talk shit. Save energy. Drive.
Doc, first on driving duties, spared himself a small smile and coaxed the horses onto the road out of the ville.
Hey, why the fuck are we still driving shit horses?
I checked out their motorized wags, Jack. All of theirs were old and pretty beat up. Plus, they didn't have much fuel.
Not to mention, if we encountered the rider again, he wouldn't recognize us. He might see us as a threat. And I don't feel like going up against him just yet.
Although they set out along the route by which they had entered the ville, tracking back along the trail left by the rider almost a week before, they had no intentions of blindly following it and hoping that they might just conceivably run into him along the way. It was simply the only road in. After all, the rider was faster than they and had days of start on them. The problem here was how to try to find him. Wherever he was currently based, he could only travel as far as the fuel tanks on the bike would take him. The return journey at that. He had, by all accounts, left the ville by the same road he had entered. So his base of operations was more likely to lay back in the direction from where he had come than it was to lay on the road on the far side of the ville. If he was smart and didn't want to be followed, then he may have doubled on himself and circled the ville. But that notion didn't reconcile with their encountering him a day's wag ride along that return line. Trying to get inside such a crazed mind had given Ryan a headache. Most adversaries were easy to figure out. They either wanted money, power, or all three. Their obsessions made them easy to understand and predict. But the mystery writer seemed to be driven by something else entirely.
The things of which he speaks are very much concepts from before the new cost. There has been very little to survive that could have fully informed him of such notions.
Particularly if he was out here living in it. Let's face it. A lot of our notions about the law and justice meant squat once we actually had to adjust and survive.
True, my dear doctor. We were soon disabused of such concepts, even if we retained the knowledge. Yet our mysterious friend seems to still have an intrinsic belief that such a thing is possible. Now that shows a peculiarly muddled sense of reality, does it not? Yet he seems quite rational in other ways.
You're right. The rider has the ability to function to a high degree. So how could you get that combination? That isolation and that knowledge that would enable you to still function, yet have no real idea of the world in which you lived.
Lori.
Mildred looked at Doc, her brow furrowed. Lori was before she had joined them, but Mildred had heard tell of her. A glance around to the others confirmed her suspicions. Lori Quint, the tall blonde with the short skirt. She'd been Doc's companion for a short while, until she died. She had been born and raised in a redoubt, never seeing the outside world until Ryan and the others had landed in the redoubt by sheer chance.
You think he may live in a redoubt? There might be one around here?
Perhaps. Not necessarily a redoubt, but maybe a base of some kind. Somewhere that would be protected against the nuke cost. Somewhere people could interbreed without ever having to go outside.
Wouldn't be the first time we'd found crazies living like that. But as you say, those people rarely go outside.
So assuming he carries a typical amount of fuel in his bike...
What would be typical?
Well, nothing outlandish, like a nuclear engine or something like that. If he's riding on a nuclear reactor, he could drive for years without needing to refuel.
Except he'd have 20 kinds of cancer.
Well, yeah. But barring that, he can only go so far in one day. He might have a base somewhere along a line from the Ville we just came from. We can narrow the search by drawing a circle that could encompass other Villes in the area, and work in from there.
They had little in the way of maps to work from, but JB was an excellent navigator and plotter. Some judicious questioning of the people from the Ville gave him the names and rough locations of other Villes in the area, along with an indication of distance by the time it usually took to travel between them. Using old pre-dark maps of the area, leading to the Grand Canyon and new mechs that were among the papers he always carried with him, he was able to prescribe a rough circle, within which lay three other Villes. It would take them several days to visit all of them, and the reception they would receive was a variable to be met with caution, but it was a plan that gave them somewhere to begin the search. JB's map and route prescribed an arc that would take them 360 degrees back to their starting point. Along the way, they would hope to pick up more information about the mystery rider that they could use to pinpoint his base of operations. It would be a long, arduous task, but there was little else they could do to make it any easier. As they made the tedious journey, under the boiling sun or the freezing moon, they looked across the desolate landscape for any sign of the rider. There was none before they came to the first Ville on their route. Station Brownsville had no old pre-dark rail depot from which it could have derived its name. There was little in the way of old railroad that had even traversed this section of the Deathlands, as they knew too well from past experience. The origin of its name was a mystery, except that it rang some distant bell in Mildred's recollections. It was of no matter. Like the Ville they had originally stumbled upon, Station Browns was, in effect, little more than a way station for passing trade. And as there was little that passed this way, it was as dirt poor as its neighbors. The little they had gleaned about it indicated that it was not much more than a pesthole Ville, with a gaudy house that paid its way and a nice line and home brew that traveled well. There was a kind of rivalry between Station Brownsville and a Ville called Casa Bel Taco, which had a similar trade. But there was enough distance between them for horny and thirsty convoys and travelers to keep both in business. On the third day out, both Jack and Christy felt inexplicably uneasy. There was no scent, no sound that Jack could put a name to, yet he could feel that out there, somewhere just beyond the limits of his senses, there was someone or something watching them. For Christy, it was much the same, except that she didn't have to rely on empirical evidence. Her ability to sense danger was almost infallible, and it was sounding alarms in her head that were impossible to ignore. Yet the landscape was deserted, and the scent seemed to fade in and out, like a badly tuned old transmitter picking up white noise that was almost, but not quite, decipherable. When it was strong, it was very strong. Yet, just as quickly it would fade out, before returning with a great intensity. And so she kept quiet about it, figuring she would wait until she could pin it down a little better. The feeling was non-existent when they got their first view of Station Brownsville. Across the flat plain, the Ville was still several miles away, a good 2 or 3 hours by horse, and the Ville looked to be undamaged. It was only as they got closer that the truth became apparent. Back at the Thunder Rider's base, there was a brainwave recorder. It would take his memories and digitally encode them, allowing him to study them in detail. This would be needed as there was something about the people he had passed in the horse-drawn wagon, something that had stuck in his mind the entire ride back to his headquarters. He had left maintenance and refueling for later. First, he must solve the mystery of these travelers. The LED was simple to set, and he selected the decoder option, plugging the headset into the jack on the console before carefully positioning it on his skull. Seating himself, he relaxed, taking deep breaths as he had been taught, before punching the key that would set the program in operation. The trick was to think about anything else other than what you wanted to capture. If you tried too hard and brought it to mind, then you would be dragging it from the memory center, making it hard for the computer to scan and collect. He diverted himself by thinking about his favorite video, the one where the cowboy found the underworld kingdom ruled by the Ice Queen. She was merciless to begin with, but only in the protection of her people. She had taught him that to do good, you had to be prepared to sometimes do things that would be bad. Unless, of course, you were doing them to people who would do even worse. His sister had told him of that old saying, "You can't make an omelet without breaking an egg." He knew what eggs were, of course, but he wondered what they tasted like. He had never seen one, other than in pictures. A monitor screen flickered to light, a message appearing to tell the Thunder Rider that the scan of the area was complete, the images captured. Letting his mind wander had worked, as he hoped it would. Sometimes he found it hard not to think of things that concerned him. Thunder Rider deactivated the system with great care. He was mindful of the fact that he was fortunate to have this legacy of equipment with which to execute his mission, and he didn't wish to waste or damage it with carelessness. The computer program did it all for him. He had merely to key in the sequence to play, and then watch. The events of the past 2 days played out before him. He hit the key to fast forward to the relevant section, not wishing to view all of his life over again so soon. When it came to the relevant section, he marked it on the toolbar, where it began, where it ended. He cut it out and played it over and over again, switching the angles, enhancing the image, zooming in and out. He wanted to try to catch as much of a view of the inhabitants of the wagon as he could. It was far from easy. They had adopted defensive postures that were so accomplished that little of them could be gleaned. However, he could tell that there were six of them. One of them was small and pale, and he had white hair, as did another. One was dark-skinned, and one... For a moment, his breath was taken away. A flash of hair, a brilliant red, waving in a non-existent breeze, as though the hair were alive. It couldn't be. He saved the best images he could and left them on the screen. Each of the six images centered on one of the people hiding behind the wagon. Swiveling in his chair, the Thunder Rider went to another monitor. This terminal archived all the reports, visual and verbal, that had been collected by the base's intel-gathering equipment since the time of the Long Night. There was, to tell the truth, very little. This system had been designed for use in the days before the darkness, and it had a vast capacity for memory. It was a sign of how things had degenerated that only a fraction of its vast storage capacity was in use. This made it simple for the search facility to scan intel for correlation with the people on the screen. The search brought several matches, recorded over a period of time. There was precious little to go on, as there were very few facilities capable of broadcast and communication technology these days. But these sparse mentions added up to a picture, one that Thunder Rider had noted while he had scanned the outside, preparing for his entrance. This group of people, who seemed to have added and lost a few members over time, but remained the same core nucleus, had, like himself, been forces of justice. They were the kind of allies he sought. The vision of the red hair floating in a non-existent breeze stirred something within him. It was something new. Something he had never felt before. He was determined now. When he had completed maintenance and refueling, when he had rested himself, then he had to find them. He had to find her.